agnostics, long-haired weirdos, short-haired weirdos, vandals, hooligans.
Love the government, hug the government, love the government, hug the government, love the government.
Welcome to The Politics Guys, a place for bipartisan, rational, and civil debate on American politics and policy. I'm Michael Baranowski, a professor of political science at Northern Kentucky University. I'm joined today by my conservative counterpart, Cleveland area attorney and defender of freedom, Jay Carson.
Hey, good afternoon, Mike.
Hey, Jay, how you doing?
Well, so I got the whole family out of town, so I'm lonelier than Liz Cheney at Lincoln Day dinner.
Oh, very, very good. I like that. All right. Well, I'm happy I can be here to maybe make you feel a little bit less alone. And we got a lot to talk about today. As always, we're going to speaking of Liz Cheney, talk about those January 6th hearings, the death threat on Justice Kavanaugh and issues related to that, the more on guns, the summit of the Americas, the baby formula shortage, something we haven't talked about. It's been going on for a while. Gas prices and oil company profits. And we'll see if we'll get to. I keep on talking about our uniquely stupid last decade. One day, Jay, today. I don't know. Anyway, we are going to get started with all of that in just a second. Well, we open with the primetime January 6th hearings, a two-hour made-for-TV event, if you will, and the first of six scheduled public hearings over the next few weeks. Now, the ostensible goal of the hearings is to lay out for the public and for history a clear, complete, and comprehensive record of the attempts to overturn the 2020 presidential election, attempts that, of course, culminated in a mob takeover of the Capitol on January 6th. Now, the nine-member panel is technically bipartisan, but two Republican members, aforementioned Liz Cheney and Adam Kinzinger, are, I'd say, seen by many in the Republican Party as something of turncoats for their participation in this. And the panel is headed by Democrat Benny Thompson, who last night said that January 6th was the culmination of a coup attempt and that democracy remains in danger. Now, Republican Liz, Republican Liz Cheney played a prominent role. She was chosen to read one of the most damning pieces of testimony featured last night from White House staffers who told the committee that when Trump was told that rioters were chanting, "Hang Mike Pence," commented, "Maybe our supporters have the right idea. Mike Pence deserves it." So, Jay, I think I know how you feel about Mike Pence deserving it, but what are your thoughts in general on what happened last
night?
I've been
on the record on that.
Yeah, it's a very good record on that, as you've been consistent. But what are your thoughts about what happened last night? And because we're recording this on Friday, I should mention, and more generally, the January 6th committee and this series of hearings that just started out last night.
So I should start with a confession slash caveat, I guess, right? And that is, I did not watch the hearings just last night.
You tuned into Fox News and had no idea they were going on. No,
exactly. I was like, "Where are they? What the hell?" No, I had tickets to go see a band, and I did that instead. So
I can understand that.
That I had sort of prearranged, right? You know, right before I knew this was going to happen. So, have you ever heard of the War on Drugs, Mike?
The War on Drugs. It seems vaguely familiar.
Band.
Yes. Oh, a band. No. Okay.
Beginner Republican.
Okay,
So, no, our more hipster listeners will be familiar.
Gotcha,
anyway, that's where I was. So I missed seeing it live, but I have seen excerpts and I've read the reviews. And my sense is a couple things. One, at least in episode one, we didn't learn anything really shockingly new that we didn't know before. In terms of new factual information, right? I mean, let's put it this way. Did you learn any new facts?
The bombshell revelations will be saved for the series finale.
Yeah. So there was that. The other piece is that I think is sort of, not weird, but the Liz Cheney statement, and Benny is different from Benny Thompson's statement. There are a lot of things I like and have always liked about Liz Cheney. I think I get what I think she's doing, right? I mean, she sees Trumpism as a virus or a cancer on the Republican on the Republican Party, and one that needs to be excised. And I think I get that. And I think I also get the sense of listen, Trump's actions or inactions on and around January 6th are indefensible, right? Yeah, or let me put it this way, are indefensible to charges of, I think, dereliction of duty, of irresponsibility. Are they defensible as to whether he committed crimes? Yes, I think they are defensible there. But I think there's also a good faith, argument she's making that, look, the president was woefully incompetent or, again, failed to act when he should have acted. And I think that's important for history to note.
Yeah. And, right? And, you know, I should point out that in typical Trumpian fashion, on Truth Social, Donald Trump just recently posted, right, that January 6th was not simply a protest. It represented the greatest movement in the history of our country to make America great again. The Trump is doubling down on his insanity, because that's how he works.
Yeah. I don't really know that, how do I feel about this or what issues do I have with it? I think it's important, for historical record that these things come out. My position early on was this is sort of a political hit job from the start, as shown by sort of the membership of the committee and all that sort of stuff. And I think the committee's decision or recommendation or verdict or whatever you want to call what finally comes out of this was made long before, even before the committee was even started. And that conclusion is that Donald Trump intentionally, incited a riot in order to overthrow the government. I think that's nonsense. But there's
a second part of that. And I think when we talk about January 6th, again, I think this is part of what the committee's trying to do is to argue that correctly, I believe, that this was not just an event, but a culmination of a larger organized attempt to basically, go back on to try to subvert the will of the American people. And I think there's plenty of evidence of that, that Donald Trump pushed very hard and explored every means, legal or not, where he could get support to try to remain in office. And to me, the case for that is almost incontrovertible.
I guess where I differ with you on that is and this goes back to how we evaluate Trump. And my position was since January 3rd, when I read the transcript of the call, with Brad Raffensperger's in Georgia, is that Trump was delusional.
Mentally ill.
He really believed. sort of, it was pretty funny. I don't know why this popped up in my Google feed, but it had something about Jason Alexander, his thoughts on the January 6th.
It's not a lie if you believe it, Jerry.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, no, it was more just, this is so terribly important and all that. But yeah, it immediately brought to me the mind that the Costanza defense, which I think is what Trump's is it's not a lie if you believe it. And I think he really does believe that he won the election based on the syllogism that you and I discussed a while back is I'm a winner. Winners win. If I didn't win, someone must have cheated.
Right. Not me.
And that's,
yeah.
Yeah.
No. Yeah.
I think that's the premise that he's proceeding from. And I think that, he sees this and some of his followers see this not as a, hey, we are trying to subvert the will of the people. We're trying to rescue the will of the people from what was a corrupt election and these folks who fixed this. And there was an actual huge Trump landslide and all that. Now, again, setting aside that it's all factually nonsense. Right. And I think there was some pretty powerful statements from Ivanka Trump and from Bill Barr last night. We're saying no.
Ivanka's dad said, "Yeah, she's just checked out. She doesn't know the real, you know, the real truth. Yeah. He hasn't talked to the right people." Yeah. Well, let me ask you this then. So, I mean, what's more worrisome to you, the fact that currently the front runner for the 2024 Republican nomination is either A, someone who consciously attempted to subvert the will of the people and overturn a legitimate election, or B, mentally ill? Those are your choices, well, right? At the way you frame
those are my choices. I think the fact is B.
Is that more worrisome, would you say? I'm just curious. I mean,
it's troubling.
Yeah.
No. Is it worrisome? Absolutely. And I, again, don't know. He's the front runner, I guess, now, but I'm not sure that holds.
Ron DeSantis is trying really hard to change that story.
Well,
yeah.
I think it's one of those. It's sort of a couple ways to look at this is in most presidential election off years, right? If you ask someone who's the front runner,
sure.
There is the, sort of the default to whatever is the most recognizable name.
Yeah. No, absolutely. And
so,
yeah, no, that's a point well taken. So we'll know a lot more after the midterms and into 2023, really. So, yeah, that's a fair
because point. I think there's a whole lot that will come out when Republicans start campaigning of hey, you can have Ron DeSantis who offers you a lot of the, Trumpian type policies.
The craziness but, without the insanity, you know. So
exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Just crazy enough.
Yeah.
My issues with Donald Trump have been, well, I shouldn't say all my, you know, my only issues, but the post-election behavior.
And also his general incompetence when he was in office. You always took issue. We regularly took issue with that, you know.
I forgot about that.
Yeah. So he's crazy and incompetent, which is not the guy you want leading your ticket, certainly. You, Jay Carson. I think that's a good place to be.
Correct.
Point,
yeah.
You know, yeah. So yeah. You know, one thing I think we both actually agree on is, well, I do believe that it's important for there to be kind of a clear, comprehensive, compelling narrative for, if nothing else, to sake history. This is a horrible way to go about it. One level, I feel incredibly resentful. There's this thing, there's a historian, a well-revered, respected historian, Daniel Boorstin, who wrote a book in 1962 called The Image.
A Bright and Shining Lie.
That's another guy. But I think his name was Daniel, too. But anyway,
yeah.
And he coined this term pseudo-event, which basically is for these created news events, which is exactly what this is. And I resent being these sort of very blatant, transparent attempts to manipulate me through creation of pseudo events. Yeah, you know, that doesn't sit right with me. But more fundamental than that to me is, if that was the true point to do what I said about the narrative for history and clear and compelling and all that, well, let's think about how you would do that. This would absolutely not be the way you do that with six hearings spread out over 2 weeks and six, 2 hours apiece, 12 hours of hearings. That doesn't accomplish that. If I wanted to put together that sort of clear narrative, it would be a single document I would release, maybe with the video along with it, if you want to include that. And I get that, but not this political miniseries with the blockbuster finale and all that. You know, in fact, my approach would have been find a lead investigator, someone who's really respected by both sides. Maybe ideally, I would say a U.S. attorney that had been appointed by Trump, right? And then you let that person pick a staff and have no members of Congress directly involved in this kind of questioning, preening, presenting, bloviating kind of stuff. And at the same time, to appoint a separate investigator to look into the 2020 BLM protests, as a lot of folks on the right in Congress wanted. And then that's what you would do if you really cared about the truth here. But, you know, I've said it before, politicians are, generally speaking, at least at this level, they're awful people. They're not good people. I don't care who says otherwise. There may be some exceptions. I'm sure there are, but for the most part, they're deeply broken, messed up, awful, narcissistic, power hungry, sad, psychologically broken people. And they're the ones who run our country. And this is what you get. So this was never about the truth. You're right about that. I agree with you. But I think the truth is important. But we're not going to get this out of this committee, sadly. So that's kind of my take on how you would go about it if you really cared about those things. And I wanted to, well, what do you think about that?
Well, I mean, and part of me, no, I agree with you 100% on the spectacle of this.
Yeah.
And the fact that, you know, the committee reached out to various television producers to, you know, yeah, put this together to make it a compelling TV show rather than actual hearings.
It offends me on such a deep level, Jim, I gotta say. It really does. I understand the reasoning.
I get that, though, yeah, right? I mean, I think there's not I don't think among the vast majority of viewers, if there are viewers, right, who would tune into this, would say, "Wow, this is shocking news," and it's not just a partisan infomercial.
Yeah.
And not that there's anything necessarily wrong with partisan infomercials, even, but let's call it what it is, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's, think about it. That's what, you know, political conventions are, right? It's a partisan infomercial.
Exactly.
But
it's still, yeah, news.
Dress it up with the appearance of this is a somber hearing, yeah, right? And all the gravitas and all, especially when it's just, you know, essentially one party doing it. The other thing that strikes me about this that makes it just bad television is I'm looking back and thinking of other like high drama government hearings, right? And obviously the big one that I was alive for but don't really remember was Watergate.
Sure.
I do remember this is like a first memory of mine almost, right? Is the word Watergate and my parents talking about Watergate. And I would have been 3 years old. You know, my mom has the story about she gave birth to my sister like during the Watergate hearings. That was sort of, you know, what she was like watching the whole time when. And part of the Watergate hearings, and then the next one that jumps to mind is the Iran-Contra hearings, which I was old enough to remember and watch, and Oliver North standing, you know, broad-shouldered and, you know, in front of Congress and. And the beautiful Fawn Hall, what was it?
Their fabulously 80s hair. Yeah, I remember. Yeah, all that, yeah.
But anyway, I mean, that had the excitement in that was, and even the Clarence Thomas, Anita Hill hearings, which were a little different in that they're confirmation hearings as opposed to a investigative hearing. But what tied that all together for the most part is, you didn't know what was going to happen, right? And you were watching news happening then and there. You know, it was like, oh my God, what's he going to say? In this case, you really don't have any of that.
Yeah, it's all scripted. Yeah, absolutely.
And I think that just takes away some of the drama.
So they're not hearings. I mean, properly stated.
Let's put it this way. I don't think there's anyone in America who would say, boy, January 6th was Donald Trump's finest hour.
Except Donald, right? Trump, apparently. Except who believes, Donald, yeah. Yeah, and maybe like a certain small but very loud percentage of his followers.
Yeah, and even that small percentage would still be like, he probably should have called in the National Guard. You know what I mean?
Apparently now, though, Trump says that he called in 20,000 troops, though there's conveniently no record of that actually, right, happening. So but like you said, he lives in his own universe where,
yeah,
if he decides that's what the past was, that's what the past was. So anyway.
And so, I mean, so what we're left is this sort of, I mean, it's an interesting topic for discussion, like between you and me was, look, was this a premeditated you know, coup to overthrow the will of the people, or is he just delusional? Is it a little bit of both? Was he, you know, he spouted off and said a lot of irresponsible things, and there was a protest that got out of hand? Or was this, again, a premeditated attack of people who really were going to hang Mike Pence and all that? And those are things that, that, you know, partisans can talk about, but there's no real news bomb revelation, I don't think, that's going to come out.
Yeah.
At least not yet, right? Unless we've got, you know,
the committee's, like, you know,
if,
yeah,
if Bill Barr shows up and says, Donald Trump ordered me to kill Mike Pence.
Yeah.
You know, that would yes. be news. I don't anticipate that.
In the gripping finale. Yeah. No, but I mean, that the committee's kind of leaked like a sieve. So it's not yeah. like, yeah, we're, I don't think we're.
Well, but that was the point of the committee in the first place.
Yeah.
Right. Was the kind of, it's sort of like, you know, all like the, here's the, you know, trailer for the, you know, next episode of Kenobi kind of thing. Right.
Yeah.
that's the whole thing, is you leak to kind of create buzz. Or even if there's an email from someone in Trump's inner circle, if there's an email from Peter Navarro, Enrique, the head of the Proud Boys, thanks for your commitment to storming the Capitol.
Here's the doors we're leaving open or something. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. You know, but I think more sort of insidious than that are these legal or extra legal efforts, not the clearly criminal riot sort of things that were done, and that will be featured in future episodes of this series. Though we already know, I think there may be revelations. Who knows? I would be surprised, but we kind of already know. We talked about Eastman and that whole kind of plan and so forth. And I should point out that, you know, Congress has the authority to hold these hearings because of its ability to legislate on this. And there's actually been, during the time this has gone on in this last week, some fairly underpublicized movement on this. This week, it was actually reported that Senate negotiators are close to coming to an agreement on a bipartisan deal to amend the Electoral Count Act to make it clear that the vice president's role is strictly ministerial, meaning that he just announces the votes and doesn't have any kind of independent role in certifying or accepting them.
The vice president does not select the next president.
Exactly. Exactly.
We thought we all knew.
Yeah.
But yeah.
But yeah. But there's also supposedly something in there that's going to raise the bar for a congressional objection, making other changes as well. And this is the important stuff, I think, because I think, you know, not to say that the riot wasn't horrific, but using these sort of semi-legal mechanisms that will still be potentially in place and vulnerable in a way that I'm assuming Capitol security won't be in 2024, well, or January of 2025, that's a whole different thing. And I think it's at least encouraging that there does seem to be at least some likelihood that Congress will address what I see to be one of the real key problems here.
Yeah, no, I think that's absolutely right. I mean, the Electoral Count Act was and is, I think, unconstitutional. It was passed for a very specific situation that happened to exist at a very specific point in time and is unlikely to ever be repeated. I absolutely think it should be gotten rid of.
You know, one other thing I wanted to talk about on this is earlier in the week, Fox got a lot of attention for deciding to not cover it, right? And
yeah.
I mean, they're in a way, I agree with them and I don't. I agree with them for all the reasons we talked about, for all the reasons why we're seeing less and less coverage of party conventions, because of course it is in a lot of ways what you call a partisan hit job. Yeah. No, I agree. I feel that part that Trump deserves to be hit for what he did, not literally. I'm not saying hang Donald Trump or anything, but still there's a legitimate journalistic point. And if it hadn't come from the network that covered Donald Trump rallies live wall to wall, maybe that would have a little more, yeah. You know. So, yeah, that Fox is full of it, but they're right at the same time, I think. At least that's my take on it.
Well, my read on Fox piece is, one, I think they probably should have covered it. Again, just in terms of showing if they're going to be fair and balanced, right? If they're going to show their journalistic credentials, right?
To be fair, to be fair to them, Jay, they retired Fair and Balanced, that tagline, back in 2017, along with We Report, You Decide. And I think...
Oh, I didn't know
that. Yeah, I didn't either. I looked into it. Their most current tagline is standing up for what's right, as far as I can tell. Oh. At least they're admitting what they are, you know, and right. there's something
well,
to be
I
said
like
for that.
We Report, You Decide. I mean, that's more of my mindset. And I would have... would rather them have done it just for, again, their own integrity as a news operation that to say, hey, look, we are not just the Donald Trump press shop.
But they are.
They did have Brett Baer cover it on Fox Business.
Right.
And the other piece of this, I think it's really a business decision by Fox that if you look at they have very highly rated programs in that primetime Thursday slot viewed by people who would be pretty strong Trump partisans, and it would probably turn off a lot of that viewer base.
Yeah, absolutely.
It would cost them ratings. It would cost them viewers. So I think they made the call of heart, right? But if you're sort of a serious minded person, or at least I shouldn't say serious minded. That's giving people who watch this too much of a compliment. But we're going to have it on Fox Business. If you just like the other, you know, you tune in for your usual Hannity and Tucker Carlson, and all that.
They're in the business of giving their audience what it wants. They know what that audience wants, and it's not 2 hours of people haranguing Donald Trump.
Yeah.
So there you go. It's a smart business decision by Fox, and I don't blame them for that. But their argument it's partisan.
Look, if you're going to call yourself a news organization,
just put it in quotes. Yeah, whatever. You know, Fox News.
You can say this hearing is a farce, but you can still cover it because it's happening, right? The fact that it's happening is news.
Yes.
Regardless of its farcicality.
Yes. I mean, I think you're right. If Fox News were a serious news organization anymore, they would. And I would say the Fox News of even 5 or 6 years ago would have covered it. Absolutely. But the Fox News of the Trump era is a very different sort of thing. And it's morphed into, like I said, news, you know, so there you go. But they know their audience. All right. Anything else on the hearings before we move on?
Not really, but I guess we'll stay tuned. And when's episode 2? I'll make sure I don't have anything else going on there.
I know that there are, like I said, a 5 more schedule, but I'm not sure on the day. I am sure we will get plenty of advance warning on that, though. And if anything merits discussion, then we will certainly bring it up. So let's move on to talk about some very, I'd say, disturbing news this week. You know, on Wednesday of this week, 26-year-old Nicholas John Roski was arrested outside the home of Supreme Court Justice Brett Kavanaugh. And when he was arrested, Roski had with him a number of things, a Glock 17 with a couple of magazines, pepper spray, a tactical knife, a hammer, a screwdriver, a crowbar, zip ties, and of course, duct tape, because, you know, you need that in your bag. Anyway, according to the Washington Post and other sources, he was upset over the leaked Supreme Court opinion that would overturn Roe versus Wade, and he planned, to kill Justice Kavanaugh and then himself in an attempt that he felt would maybe give his life purpose. And the would-be murderer is said to have found Justice Kavanaugh's address online, and home addresses of the Republican-appointed justices were actually posted online by a pro-abortion group called Ruth Sent Us after the draft opinion leaked. And shortly after Justice Alito's draft leak, Attorney General Merrick Garland directed the U.S. Marshals Service to provide around-the-clock security at the homes of all the justices in the wake of what you would expect, increased threats and protests, both at the court and outside of justices' homes. And after Roski's arrest, Attorney General Garland told reporters that threats of violence and actual violence against the justices, of course, strike at the heart of our democracy, and we will do everything we can to prevent them and to hold people who do them accountable. And just 2 days after the leak of Justice Alito's opinion, a draft opinion, Texas Republican Senator John Cornyn, who serves on the Senate Judiciary Committee introduced the Supreme Court Police Parity Act of 2022, which was passed 4 days later by unanimous consent in the Senate. And this would provide the justices security equivalent to the legislative and executive branches, which would include providing protection for immediate family members if the Marshal Service feels that that's necessary. Now, this hasn't yet been approved by the House because Democrats are hoping to put together a bipartisan, a broader consensus bill that would extend protection to clerks and other Supreme Court staffers, though Speaker Pelosi said late this week that she plans a vote on the measure next week. So, Jay, what are your thoughts on all this?
I say it's, I guess, sadly predictable.
Yeah, yeah.
Right?
Well put.
Eventually, this would happen. This would come to it's fortunate that he was stopped or stopped himself before this went any further. I think it ought to be a call to people right and left, but mostly left, to dial back the rhetoric on these things. I mean, I'm thinking of the Chuck Schumer statements of 2020 about you have unleashed the whirlwind and you're not going to know what hit you. Those statements made directed at the Supreme Court on the steps of the Supreme Court in 2020.
Or calls to hang the vice president, right? You know.
Exactly.
That would fit in.
As I said, I'm against hanging the vice president. But the I guess the the other piece of this that I find troubling is we do have federal statute on the books that prevents picketing at justices' homes in order to try to gain some sort of advantage or persuade them on an opinion that the Justice Department has chosen not to enforce. And I think that's the White House has refused to condemn these protests at the justices' homes. Again, that they support the right to peaceful protest. And again, for a lot of, if you're a Republican, that sort of has the echo of 2020 in terms of peaceful protest and what that means. So,
well, you know, I'll say, Jay, on that, there's a line, right, between peaceful protest and harassment. And
yeah.
I think you and I both support the right to peaceful protest, but I think we both also are against harassment.
Oh yeah. So, no, but when I referred to that, the 2020 thing was that the euphemism for so many of the protests of 2020, where it was the reporter reporting on the mostly peaceful protest with the building burning in the background.
Well, sure. Yeah. That there are elements within a lot of large protests, whether they're whatever they are. Yeah.
And again, I would say there's no First Amendment issue here at all. The First Amendment allows reasonable time and place restrictions on speech.
Yeah.
And if you want to protest out in front of on the steps of the Supreme Court, well, have at it. If you want to schedule a march down Constitution Avenue or rally in front of your state house or whatever, that's all very, very protected. And you have absolutely every right to do that. But the harassment of public officials at their own homes, I think, very much crosses the line. And I
agree.
I
think it's part and parcel of a really astonishing decline in just general trust in government over time. I mean, starting from really the late 50s, which is kind of where modern polling started, through the mid 60s, around 70% or more of Americans trusted the government to do the right thing most of the time or just about always. Look, in 2022, only around 20% of Americans feel the same way. That's enormous, right? And the thing is this isn't just party based, because even while people tend to have higher levels of trust when their party controls the presidency, even then, the last time a majority of people in the president's own party had a high level of trust or a more than 50% level of trust was 2006. So it's over 15 years ago, right? So, and the court's been different to an extent. There have been higher levels of trust, but even the court's been sucked into this, right? Unfavorable impressions of the court have been on the rise with majority disapproval of the court and of the justices as well. And of course, I think so much in our political rhetoric just drives this. I mean, and I'll, for instance, Ken is an incredibly smart guy, our own Ken Katkin, right? And I agree with him on a lot. But one thing I just very strongly disagree with him on is when he calls the justices corrupt. I feel that's wrong, and that's kind of builds into this sort of mood that we get, this sort of feeling that we get. And you know, we see more and more of this sort of thing. So that's kind of my take on that.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely correct on that, and that there are plenty of Supreme Court decisions that looking, I wouldn't say plenty, but there are certainly Supreme Court decisions that you can look at and say, look, I think the court got this wrong. And that's something completely different from the court is corrupt and a partisan actor.
Well, no, I think those are two different things. And let me explain.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. There's completely different.
I mean,
you can say, listen, I still respect this as a, it's a Supreme Court precedent. It's the law. I might not agree with it, but it is still a legitimate, it's still legitimately the law of the land.
Yeah, I see what you're saying. I guess the distinction I would make is between corruption and partisanship. I don't believe that the court is corrupt in any meaning of the term that I take.
Right. But, we're not getting paid off.
Right. But I do believe that the court is much more partisan and filled with partisan actors. And I would expect it would be weird to me if it weren't, because, of course, the court is a reflection of the political environment in which justices are nominated. And so if you're a if you're a very partisan president in a partisan environment, what sort of justice or what sort of judge are you going to want to nominate to be on the Supreme Court? Well, someone who's more of an ideologue. That just makes sense. I mean, so I don't blame the justices, you know, for like choosing to be whatever partisan. They're just, that's the pool that we're drawing from more now. And so, I mean, for instance, if you take a look at the history of Supreme Court confirmations, right? The last, unequivocally, bipartisan Senate vote on a Supreme Court nominee was John Roberts. And this was 78-22, which for the time that wasn't unusual, but we haven't seen much like that since. And when you think about John Roberts and how he's ruled and the sort of person he is, he's pissed off a lot of people on both sides. I mean, he very much is an institutionalist. I think he's very much a conservative, certainly, but he's not driven primarily by ideology. And because of that, he's made some decisions. He's ruled in some ways that have upset a lot of ideologues on the right. And again, I disagree with Roberts on a lot, but I respect him in a way that I don't respect some of the other justices, simply because I think they were chosen for different reasons. And I think their confirmation votes reflect that.
Well, I'd also point out, I think there's a difference between ideology and partisanship.
Yeah.
There's often an overlap, and the two often go hand in hand. But it's not necessarily the same thing. And my concern about partisanship on the court would be the, you know, the president picks up the phone, Donald Trump, and, you know, whatever, calls whatever justice and says, hey, we got this, right? You know, it's that sort of corrupt political influence. That would is what I would consider both corrupt and partisan.
Yeah, that would be corrupt, yeah.
You know, so that's you know, but and look, when they're, this is all the more important because that's such an important issue. That you don't have sort of a boy who cried wolf type situation. You know what I mean? That, so when you have actual corruption, when there is something really, really corrupt going on, people take it seriously and don't just view it as, oh, that's just background noise. That's what they always say.
Right.
So I think that's the other thing is you have to be very careful in throwing around those terms, because, it does damage to the court as a whole. And also lessens the shock or the what ought to be done when there is real corruption.
Yeah. No,
I'm not saying there's any real corrupt. Well, let me put, I will put this way. There is sort of a blatant breach of ethics in whoever leaked the opinion.
Yeah.
I think that's a little different than corruption.
Yes.
And that corruption tends to imply, I don't know, maybe more self-serving, more.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, accepting something of value in exchange for a service that you're not yet.
But it's sort of, abandoning your duty, right? Your ethical duty. So I guess it's kind of.
Well, rough. Even then, I mean, I would argue that.
The idea is usually that there's something else that you're getting out of
it. Yeah, exactly.
Maybe they're just getting out of it the, you know, what we have right now of aha, now we've put pressure on these justices, and maybe either we make it, you know, somebody actually changes their vote, or we make it a campaign issue enough that we can energize Democrats enough right. to stave off a red wave.
Yeah.
So,
you know, to me, this goes back to, I mean, I talk a lot about how processes, procedures, institutions shape results. And I think that happens to a lot of people, you know, in the background. But this to me is in part, at least I would argue, the result of eliminating the filibuster for judges and then, you know, Supreme Court justices. Just for folks who don't know the history, right? Senate Democrats eliminated the filibuster for lower court judges in 2013. Then Senate Republicans did so for Supreme Court nominations in 2017. When you think about it, I mean, the last time a Supreme Court nominee got 60 votes or more was 2010. Kagan got 64. The year before that, Sotomayor got 68. And, you know, I think that matters because presidents are going to understandably want to nominate the most ideological, consistent with them person they can, who can get through the Senate. And you lower that barrier, and that's going to make it easier.
Yeah.
And you're going to get a more polarized court. So I would love, I mean, I know the court, I know the Senate's not going to go back to
denuclearization.
Yeah, it's just not going to happen, right? But I got to say, in my not perfect world, but better world, I'd love a constitutional amendment that required a 3/5 of the Senate to confirm, And along with that, if we're amending the Constitution, you know, to require that all nominees receive a floor vote in the Senate within, say, 3 months of nomination. I think that'd be fair. 3 months doesn't seem reasonable. And you know, while we're doing it, I throw in a term limit, maybe 20 years. Or maybe, you know, there's also this thing called Rule of 80. You might be familiar with this, right?
That's the problem with constitutional amendments, Mike. Once you get started, it's hard to stop, isn't it?
Well, you know, I mean, but that's not necessarily a bad thing. I mean, certainly I think the framers thought that there would be much more of that. We haven't had a whole lot of that. So I think we have, well, you know my feeling on this. I think we have a horrifically sclerotic constitutional system that's designed very well for the problems and issues of the 18th century, but not so much for the 21st century. But and I know you're not a fan of term limits, certainly, or a rule of 80 or anything like that.
No, I'm not. For a variety of reasons.
I don't know if I mentioned this before, but you know, the idea that I think it would make more sense if every presidential election winner be given a nomination, and that could actually be done legislatively, as opposed to, because of course Congress controls the size of the size of the court.
Then you would have a constantly growing court.
Yeah, I'd be okay with that. You know, so that's fine with
right.
me.
Right. At some point, you have 47 justices or something.
They probably wouldn't get that big, but yeah, some folks would argue that if you're going to do that, you need to
become unwieldy.
Yeah, you need to combine that with some kind of a term limit idea. Now, there are some folks who have floated the idea that you could through legislation basically force justices after a certain point, say the age of 80 or the rule of 80, that's when your age and years of service equals 80, you could force them into taking sort of a required senior status, or
which is sort of what they do in the federal courts of appeal.
Exactly. So, but I think that if that ever came to the Supreme Court, that would not fly exactly. So that's
well,
my
and when you start putting, I guess, those sorts of requirements in, is it proper to still call it a Supreme Court? If you follow me,
explain. No, I'm not sure I do.
Well, I mean, it's sort of the. We are the Supreme Court, except, well, here's the guy to follow these rules and these rules and these rules. as compared to the way the Constitution reads right now, is all judicial power shall be vested in one Supreme Court.
Yeah, well, I mean, this would not change the vesting of judicial power. It would just change membership. And the court, and certainly Congress has had the right to change, you know, the size of the court and, in fact, to create any inferior courts that it wants to create, right? Because only the Supreme Court's mentioned.
Yeah, but I would say, okay, so I think there's a difference, though, in changing the size of the court and removing a sitting justice.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think you're right.
Right?
It would be kind of interesting, though, if to deal with the court size issue, you gave the winner of the presidential election the right to basically fire one member of the court and then appoint someone in their place.
Right. Well, I mean, that's
talk about reality TV.
What my argument would be, right? If you have a legislative, let's say you've got a close issue, you've got a 5-4 court, or a 17-18 court, or whatever system you've got. And you're looking at one vote, and you've got one justice who just turned 79. Big cases coming down the pike. What if Congress says, you know what? We think rule of 80 really should be rule of 79.
Yeah. Well, I mean,
all in favor? At that point, is it still a Supreme Court, is what I'm saying.
Well, of course, I should point out that Congress, under the Constitution, could, in fact, pass legislation that would remove jurisdiction for the Supreme Court, say, to hear these abortion cases.
Correct.
That'd be a pretty radical thing to do.
You could argue over that. I think, yeah, the Congress can obviously set the court's jurisdiction.
The appellate jurisdiction,
That Congress could remove the court's jurisdiction over constitutional issues. I think that's a tougher...
You know, right? I believe it could, because I think the only cases that that Congress cannot legislate away from the Supreme Court are cases that fall within the court's original jurisdiction. And of course, as you know, right, that's a vanishingly small percentage.
Like states suing states.
Exactly, that kind of stuff, some international stuff. So, but yeah, and not that, I mean, that would not actually ever happen, right? Because politically that would be a bridge way, way, way too far, but it does in fact exist in the Constitution. So.
Yeah.
But you know, another thing that, and this is, we don't really talk about this a lot, and a lot of people I don't think are aware of this, is the, what I call the slow walking of lower court nominations. You're, I'm sure, aware of this.
I'm familiar with it. Yep.
I mean, you know, in the, if we go back to the 80s, for instance, circuit court judges were typically confirmed in under 2 months, and district court judges took even less than that. And nowadays, it's like well over 3 months on average for appeals court judges and over 8 months for district court nominees. And that to me is, I just think that's just crazy. And of course, we know why it happens, because there are a lot of mechanisms by which the party that wants to slow down the changing of the judiciary is able to do things like holds and other various procedures to make that not happen. And I would like to see a return to those glory days of the Reagan years when, hey, a judge was appointed and a judge was nominated, and damn it, there was a vote on that judge.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I think you wouldn't want an amendment on that, but you would certainly, I mean, the Senate could certainly.
Right. No, and there'd be no reason for that, to amend the Constitution to do that. It's just a matter of changing a lot of the internal Senate rules.
Yeah. And that would not necessarily
allow for these slowdowns.
Yeah, I think it's just ridiculous that it can take, you know, over 200 days to confirm a district court judge. That's just nuts. I think you would agree.
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
So, but it's not like that's going to change anytime soon. I can't imagine. You don't expect it to change anytime soon, do you?
No, I don't. There have been, if you remember back in the early 2000s, there was what was called the Gang of 14. Anytime you get together a group and call them the gang of something, it's just not going to go well.
Politicians desperately want to seem cool. And so, you know, it's like, yeah.
Yeah. Well, there was the Gang of Four that ruled China for a while in the 70s. And they were sort of horrible, terrible, brutal people who, you know, killed thousands, if not millions. But that's another story. Gang of 14 wasn't that bad. But they were ineffective. And the idea was that here was a group of bipartisan senators who were going to say, okay, listen, for judges who are not controversial, we'll sort of give them the fast pass.
Yeah.
And move forward. what happened was, you know, in terms of controversial, definitions differed.
Right.
My argument would be that it turned out that if you were appointed by a Republican president, well, that was a source of controversy for some people. So that whole thing sort of fell apart, and that's how we ended up with nuclear options and so forth.
Yeah. But, yeah. Senators love their prerogatives to stop things from happening, certainly. And in some instances, maybe that's a good thing. But here, I would argue that it's not necessarily such a great thing.
Well, getting back to the Justice Kavanaugh attack, what are your thoughts in terms of? Do we need to dial back some of the rhetoric on this? And isn't this again, to me, this is a very foreseeable outcome of the leak?
Yeah, I mean, I'm glad that after the leak, Attorney General Garland took what I believe the wise step of increasing the security through the Marshal Service. And I believe that that's, in fact, at least one of the factors behind this lunatic getting caught before he could do any harm to Justice Kavanaugh. So, but I mean, yeah, I agree that it would be great if we could all, you know, not hate each other as intensely. I don't see that happening. That would be awesome. I think all decent people are repulsed at this sort of action, right? But there are plenty of people who aren't decent, and they find plenty of support from other people who aren't decent, both on the right and the left, in little corners of the internet, and that just revs them up to do horrific things like this, or try to do them.
Yeah. Do you think at some point the Biden administration should make a statement saying, we do not endorse protests at justices' houses?
You know, if I were the president, I would say that while I support peaceful protest, I believe that, you know, protesting in front of justices' houses is not a form of legitimate political protest, but is harassment and intimidation, and I do not support that. And yeah, I would have no problems.
All right.
I would have no problems directing the Justice Department, the Marshal Service, anyone else involved to very strictly enforce. As you mentioned, there's a statute against picketing in front of justice. I would have no problem enforcing that. And if someone told me I was not a fan of free speech, I would suggest that they don't know what the hell they're talking about.
Yeah, well, there you go.
So clearly, I should be president. You know, more than Joe Biden, at least. I don't know. You'd probably vote for me over Joe Biden.
I'd definitely vote for you over Joe Biden.
There's something. I got one in my. It's going to be wide open in 2024. So there you go.
Yeah.
You'd probably vote for me over, Kamala Harris. So right there.
I'd assume I'd get some sort of plum.
Cabinet
or administrative position.
Oh, you'd be attorney general. Of course you would. Not that would be corrupt. Yeah. Anyway, speaking of corruption. All right. Hey, if you're a Politics Guys supporter, we have a lot more for you. We're going to talk about some gun stuff, to some of the Americas, the baby formula shortage, gas prices, and oil company profits, and if there's a problem with that, and a bunch of that stuff. So we're going to get to that in just a second. If you're not a supporter, you can become one. Go to patreon.com/politicsguys. You can also support us through Venmo or at Politics Guys, as well as through PayPal, and you can find support links in the show notes and at politicsguys.com/support. And if you'd like to get the full show, but you're just not in a space where you can financially support us right now, no problem. Just send me an email, mike@politicsguys.com, and I will take care of that for you, no problem. And whether you're a supporter or not, it really does help us out if you subscribe, rate the show, leave a review on the podcast app you're listening to it on, and share episodes on social media. Thank you so much.